ignition system was sucking away at it. Flames leapt from the can. Conroy tossed in a raffia and dried plants from a nearby flower arrangement. More flames sparked, and noxious smoke rose.
Down the back stairs now. Let's go.
Jessica was about to let out a sigh of relief, thinking he would leave them behind. That was fine. She and Bernadette could have that fire out as soon as he left. If not, security, the rescue squad, and police authorities, maybe even the feds, would be there in a matter of minutes. Suddenly, from a pocket in his suit coat, a gun appeared.
You two, move. Both of you.
She was about to heave that cup of coffee at him when the sprinkler above her head released a deluge. Carla reached out, grabbing her arm and pulling her, not toward the doorway leading to the outer office, but in the opposite direction. A panel in the back wall of Conroy's office slid open, revealing a set of stairs. Jessica glanced over her shoulder as she turned to follow Carla. Conroy was pushing Bernadette ahead of him, pointing that gun right at her. Not again, she thought, as they headed down those stairs, going somewhere she didn't want to go, at the behest of a well-dressed thug. While making their way down 12 flights of stairs to an underground parking garage, Jessica pondered the events of the last few moments, reviewing Conroy's words. Heave-ho. Shove off. Launch plan B. Passports and money. She knew where they were heading if they could run the gauntlet of police and get away. The feds would seal off Pinnacle's parking garage, so they might not even get out of the garage. When they got down to the parking garage level, they didn't stop, but kept going, down another two levels, to a door that led from the stairwell to an underground tunnel. It was an old maintenance tunnel, thankfully, rather than the sewer system. They walked through those tunnels for a few minutes, turning several times, before exiting through a set of doors leading into another stairwell. An even more rickety set of stairs than those leading from Conroy's office awaited them. After climbing two flights, they passed through a door that Conroy struggled to open. That led into what looked like an abandoned parking garage. Hard to believe such a thing existed in a megacity desperate for room to park cars. With that little walk in the warm tunnels, Jessica felt less soggy, although her new suit was a goner and her hair was hanging in her eyes. Bernadette was in much better shape. Standing off to the left and moving out of the way quickly, she'd missed the worst of the downpour that had drenched Jessica. An older model Mercedes sedan sat off to the side of the decrepit garage. Conroy motioned for them to move to the car and get into the back. He took both of their purses and handed them to Carla. She climbed into the driver's seat as he got into the passenger seat, still holding the gun.
"Lock them in," he ordered.
Carla clicked the child locks so that they had no way to escape from the back seat. He waved the gun at them.
"No monkey business, you two, and I'll let you go. Let's just hope, for your sake, this doesn't become a hostage situation."
He smiled a cruel smile. Who was he kidding? This was a hostage situation. Jessica plotted to get that purse back. In the meantime, she would do what she could. When Conroy shifted in his seat, facing forward, Jessica nudged Bernadette. Opening the sling a little, she let Bernadette glimpse her cell phone secreted there. With the sound off, she had felt it buzz a couple of times. Peter could track them using the GPS in her cell phone, but she hoped she could text him their destination. Minutes later, she got her chance. They arrived at the exit from the poorly lit garage. A padlocked chain-link gate and bright orange traffic cones blocked their way.
"Hang on,"
Conroy said, jumping from his seat and pulling a key to the padlock from his pants pocket.
"This guy thinks of everything, doesn't he, Carla?"
Bernadette asked, leaning forward a little. Jessica slid the phone out as Bernadette kept talking.
"Can we get a little air back here? Maybe you could turn on the air conditioning or open the windows. It's stuffy. I'm sweating, and my heart's still pounding after all those stairs. Even going down them is hard for an old lady like me. I don't want to pass out on you."
While Bernadette rattled on, Carla fidgeted with the air conditioning. Conroy had that chain unlocked and was pulling it out of the way. As he moved the orange cones, Jessica slid her phone out and typed one word, Marina. When the text was on its way to Peter, she slid the phone back into the sling. Then she patted Bernadette on the shoulder. Bernadette settled back against her seat as Eric opened the door and climbed in.
That's much better. Gracias.
What's much better? Conroy asked as he fastened his seatbelt.
We've got the AC on. It was stuffy in the back seat. He shrugged as Carla pulled forward, out of the garage, and merged with traffic on the road. As far as Jessica could tell, their little detour underground had taken them several blocks from Pinnacle. Carla drove with care, leaving downtown L.A. behind. She didn't get on the freeway, but stuck with side streets until she got to Santa Monica Boulevard, heading west toward the ocean. The Sweet Retreat, anchored in Marina del Rey, wasn't far away. 20 minutes, maybe, for Peter to pick them up via GPS, or to run down the information on Eric Conroy's yacht, or both. She glanced sideways at Bernadette. Her lips were moving as she prayed. Rosary beads, the beautiful crystal beads her beloved Guillermo had given her before he disappeared, were in her fingers.
God, please listen to her. This is on me, not her. So mercy. Please?
As soon as they turned onto Santa Monica Boulevard, Conroy called ahead to the crew of the Sweet Retreat.
This is Eric. I'll be there in 20 minutes, and I expect you to be ready to head out. Got it?
He'd just ended the call when his phone rang.
Yeah, Kirk. I know. We got out of there just in time. Thanks for the heads up.
He paused, listening to Kirk.
I'll send it to you. You know I'm good for it. I won't even ding you either for not getting the job done.
That must have sent Kirk off, because Conroy held the phone away from his ear. He let Kirk go on for another minute or two, said goodbye, and ended the call. His phone rang several more times before they arrived at the marina, but he didn't pick it up again. Not too many places could provide anchorage for a 100-foot yacht like the Sweet Retreat. It was easy to spot. When Carla parked the Mercedes, Conroy had the gun out again, motioning for them to get out.
This is ridiculous, Jessica thought.
I'm not sure what you have in mind, but you don't need us. Not both of us, anyway. Let Bernadette stay put here in the car. Lock her in the back seat, and she won't be able to get out. While they were talking, Bernadette scooted forward, reached into the front seat, and picked up both of their purses. He was chewing the bottom of his lip again, perhaps considering what she said.
Get out, both of you. When we're at sea, we'll put you in a dinghy and you can paddle your way back. It's the least I can do, as much trouble as you've caused me, according to that idiot car anyway.
He waited for Jessica to join Bernadette. She helped Jessica put the strap of her shoulder bag over her head, crossbody style.
Move it,
Conroy barked. He motioned toward the dock. The Sweet Retreat sat in deep water at the end of a long, narrow, floating walkway that wobbled as they trudged to the yacht. They had to walk single file, with Carla in the lead and Eric bringing up the rear. On either side were smaller boats moored along the way. Jessica could glimpse parallel walkways on either side, too. She hoped she might spot Peter, and for a second thought she saw a figure off to her left. When they arrived at the yacht, Conroy stepped ahead of them and onto a gangplank for boarding the yacht. That's when Plan B went overboard, so to speak.
Put that gun away. This is a mutiny, Andrea Jessup said, laughing as she and a crew member on board the yacht peered down at him. Each held guns of their own.
Big guns. When he hesitated, Carla got into the act.
I'd listen to the dried-up old hag if I were you.
She was holding a gun on the man now, too.
What the?
Before he could finish, a bullet zinged past them. They all hit the ground. Eric's gun flew away, landing in the water with a splash. Jessica's ribs were screaming as she landed with a thud on the bag she wore. As soon as she could see straight, she looked around for cover. At the same time, she tried to figure out who had fired that shot. On a parallel walkway, she could see the figure of a young woman in a baggy shirt and sweatpants.
Dick's dead, and it's all your fault, Shannon Donnelly cried out,
her hands shaking with rage or some other intense emotion. She had a gun aimed right at Jessica. Conroy, egoist that he was, didn't get it. He
He assumed she was talking to him.
What are you talking about? I had nothing to do with Carr's death. It was Dick's idea to take you out, too, so don't blame me for that either.
He was getting back up on his knees from the prone position he had taken when Shannon fired that shot.
How come you're still alive?
Jessica wondered about that, too, as she motioned Bernadette to scoot back, putting a boat in a slip to their left in between her and Shannon. Bernadette did that, but also pointed at Jessica's bag.
Liar, liar,
Shannon said, firing wildly. This time, she was shooting at Conroy, with no more success than she had when shooting at Jessica. He let out a grunt as he did a belly flop, flattening himself out on the walkway. That set the walkway to bobbing again. Jessica was getting seasick as she scooted backwards toward Bernadette.
He said you were a liar. So did Libby, you red devil. Dick wouldn't kill me. We were in love.
More bullets flew, hitting the water and pinging off the side of the yacht.
Son of a...
Conroy shrieked. He grabbed at his leg as he scrambled toward Carla. Wrestling her gun free, he punched her hard in the face. She rolled off the walkway into the water. Andrea, without regard for gunfire, slid over the side of the yacht and pulled Carla's head up out of the water. The two bobbed alongside the walkway. In the distance, Jessica could hear sirens wailing. The beating blades of a helicopter could be heard, closing in on their position. Help would get here too late for Shannon, though, if she didn't do something quick. Jessica reached into her purse and removed her father's gun. She'd taken it back from Bernadette after they left Malibu. Eric Conroy was up on his knees. Crying and screaming, Shannon was pulling the trigger, but had no more bullets in her gun. Eric took aim. Propping herself up on her cast, Jessica steadied her right hand, aimed at Conroy's backside, and fired. She may have hit him, but it was hard to tell. Another shot came from that crew member up on deck who had taken cover from the salvo of bullets fired by Shannon, but was now back on his feet. He shot at Conroy maybe a split second after Jessica fired her gun. The blast that killed Conroy, though, came from a sniper rifle held by a man wearing a baseball cap and sunglasses.
"Nobody calls me Kierkegaard," he had shouted before taking that shot.
With that, he tipped his hat and tore off in a speedboat. Conroy lay still. Shannon sank to her knees, immobilized by emotion, not gunfire, because Conroy hadn't fired the gun he held. Sirens could be heard everywhere. Close now. The helicopter that was almost overhead veered away to follow the sniper. In minutes, Peter was storming toward them, followed by Brian and an army of officers from various jurisdictions. Police and EMTs pounded down the walkway toward Shannon, too.
"Hang on, Ethel," Jessica hollered as the walkway bounced.
"You too, Lucy,"
Bernadette replied. Epilogue. Jessica rode a roller coaster of emotions as she sat on the patio in Rancho Mirage. The bucolic setting lulled her, filling her with gratitude as she gazed at happy golfers at play. Mountains provided a picture-perfect backdrop to the manicured golf course. A gentle breeze caused palms to sway and carried laughter with it. That she and Bernadette were safe, unharmed by Conroy's malice or the barrage of bullets that took his life, was reason for gladness. Still, the confusion and terror she'd experienced lingered. The depths of depravity and stupidity represented by that confrontation at the sweet retreat was hard to believe. "A ship of fools," she muttered, counting herself among the fools. It had been a week since that showdown. Authorities were still sorting out all that had gone on that day, and all that had led up to that dramatic end to Eric Conroy's life. Various jurisdictions were tugging at different threads tangled up in Carr and Conroy's web of deceit, hoping to catalog the crimes and understand their schemes. Understand was the wrong word.
Could you ever do that?
Jessica wondered. Understand the harm visited on the world by ruthless men in positions of power?
"Earth to Jessica," Tommy said, waving from the swimming pool as he spoke.
"Do you want to do this or not?"
The cat pack, assembled on the sprawling patio, was there to debrief.
And eat, of course. Caterers were preparing their meal in the home's roomy kitchen while they sat around with drinks, talking. She'd already revisited the events that occurred at Pinnacle and the marina. The media, drawn by gunfire and police, arrived in droves once word got out that the Angel Heiress was in trouble again. They broadcast parts of the story again and again.
Sure. Where should we begin?
How about we start with Sally Winchester? Tommy and I have information about that diary, Jerry said as he floated in the pool on a lounger.
Yes. I suppose it makes as much sense as anything to start with Sally Winchester.
Jessica sighed. So far, she seems to be the only dead daughter, despite our fears that Shannon was dead and that Libby might not make it. It's awful that she was the victim of a ruthless collaboration between Carr and Conroy, a match made somewhere other than heaven. Each had his own scheme running when the two found each other. As we figured, Carr was using young women to extort money from his client's parents by alleging child sexual abuse based on recovered memories. Conroy put a new twist on that scheme by using Carr's extortion methods to control board members at Pinnacle. That included Ned Donnelly, Dorothy Winchester, and several others. The IPO wasn't Conroy's only strategy to profit from his position at Pinnacle. Another gambit involved in a longer con, skimming money from Pinnacle, falsifying financial documents, and hiding money offshore.
It's too bad we may never know how big a scheme Carr ran on his own, and in league with that Red Devil Conroy. A lot of his missing files are back, retrieved from the case records management service Carr used. That was a great idea, Betsy, to look to see if he had used a service like that after Conroy had Carr's home and office cleaned out, Jerry commented.
Betsy smiled as she sat next to Peter.
Yeah, that was a good one. Who even knew such a service existed?
Peter was smiling now, too.
Glad I could help.
Betsy took the praise in stride, but Jessica saw her wink at Peter, causing his smile to widen. Catpack Investigations and Matchmaking Services, Jessica thought, gazing at the newest twosome to emerge among her friends. She tried not to look at Frank in a moment of weakness created by Peter and Betsy's flirting. Frank was in swimming trunks and had thrown on a shirt when he climbed out of the pool. It was open, exposing a well-muscled chest. His hair, still wet and unruly, glistened.
Shoot, Jessica said to herself.
She was looking at him, and he caught her.
Where was I?
She wondered as she tore her eyes from his.
The Beverly Hills PD is trying to figure out how to make those records available to families that want to sue for malpractice. I'm not sure how much luck they'll have filing claims against Carr's insurance company now that he's dead.
Once the story got out about the false allegations and extortion racket Carr had going, the outcry began. When the moneyed raise a ruckus, the justice system takes notice. So who knows? There are more Libby's and Shannon's, so maybe more dead daughters like Sally Winchester, too. But I hope not. The police are picking up where you left off, Laura, checking on admissions to ERs and in the L.A. area with Dr. Richard Carr as the admitting physician. I suppose that will dredge up horrific issues for families who lost someone to an overdose in his care. Hopefully, they'll come forward, too. At least there won't be any more. Not from Carr or Conroy's dirty dealing, anyway.
Disgust must have registered on her face.
That's something. You can't track down every desperado in Couture, Tommy quipped. He was being playful, but this had stressed them all out. Jerry got them back on track.
Getting back to Sally Winchester, tell us what was in that diary we retrieved from Father Caverly. You got a look at it before turning it over to the feds.
We know Sally gave that diary to Father Caverly a few days before she died.
Why?
She had figured out by then that Carr and Conroy were in cahoots and planning to rip off investors with that IPO. Sally was angry and confused after Conroy ended their relationship, but she wasn't sure what to do. For some unknown reason, she still had feelings for that dirtbag. She was in deep, that's for sure. First love and all that. The diary is one of the most disturbing things I've ever read. Sally was on cloud nine when the year began. And then she plummeted into her own private hell. She admits Conroy put her up to extorting her parents, not for money, but to get Dottie to resign. Jessica paused and caught her breath. Anyway, that rage Sally directed at her parents all collapsed into a pool of despair once Conroy dumped her. She didn't say she was contemplating suicide, but that overdose was an accident waiting to happen. Still, Sally did the right thing and called in that tip to the feds about Pinnacle. One of the last entries in her diary was about making amends for what she'd done to her family by saving other families from that disastrous IPO. It also sounds like she had, or planned to have, a confrontation with Conroy. She wanted him to turn himself into the authorities. If that confrontation took place the night she died, she might have had a little help with that overdose. What happened the night Sally died is another mystery we won't be able to completely clear up. Thanks to Jerry, we know both Carr and Conroy were with her that night. Hotel surveillance footage puts them on the premises at different times, with Carr the last to leave. That was after he called 911. Too little, too late. But was it an error in judgment, or did he delay calling for help intentionally? Who knows? Frank shook his head, taking a sip from the beer he held. That fits with what Shannon told Detective Hernandez and other authorities. It's a miracle she survived. Maybe Carr had feelings for her. More likely, she was just lucky Carr died up there on that mountain before he cashed in big on his share of the take from the IPO. The money Shannon would get if her parents turned over control of her trust fund to her would have been chump change compared to the payday Carr hoped to get from the Pinnacle IPO. Who knows what he would have done once Conroy paid him off? Shannon was hell-bent on getting that money from her parents, and as diabolical as Libby in her quest, Jessica said. Yeah, but no better equipped than Sally Winchester or Libby Vanderwerth when she came up against those scumbags, Kim added. My guess is Carr would have done away with her, too, if he'd survived his effort to get rid of you and Libby. It could be. Libby and Shannon were both creating trouble for Carr. The last round started at their condo in Manhattan Beach, when Shannon brought that broken rosary to Libby. Shaken, she told Libby she'd overheard Conroy and Carr quarreling. Conroy didn't know that Carr had hidden Shannon in another room when Conroy barged in to chew Dr. Dick out about getting involved with daffy skirts like Libby. That infuriated the shrink, who reminded Conroy he'd had a daffy skirt problem of his own. They fought about what happened to Sally. Carr claimed he'd saved Conroy's neck by cleaning up after him that night Sally died. Apparently, that included picking up that broken rosary, straightening up so it didn't look like Sally had fought with anyone, and then calling 911. He even accused Conroy of giving Sally too many pills, or the wrong pills. Conroy countered by blaming the psychiatrist for giving Sally too many of the wrong pills. After Conroy cooled off and left, Shannon caught Carr with that broken rosary. He'd picked it up all right, but kept it, maybe to use against Conroy if he needed a little leverage of his own. Anyway, Shannon took it, but she wasn't sure what to do with it, and can't remember how it ended up in Libby's car. The blood on the crucifix is Sally's, and the partial prints a match to Conroy. "Why did Shannon take it?" Kim asked. "I know what I would have intended to do with dope like that on a weasel like Conroy, who must have ripped that rosary out of Sally's hand. These Beverly Hills chicks are hard to figure out." "You're right. I bet she was trying to protect her head-shrinker boyfriend, thinking he was in trouble about Sally," Bernadette commented from the chaise in which she sat. She was drinking something stronger than beer, a frosty margarita that Tommy had whipped up for them. "It could be. But Shannon says she felt confused since the two men had blamed each other for killing Sally. In addition to accusing Conroy of giving Sally the pills that killed her, he also told Conroy that if he'd called 911 that night before he left the hotel, Sally would still be alive. So Shannon could have been trying to nail Conroy." "What a frigging waste," Jessica groused, taking a swig of her margarita. "I don't think Shannon or Libby could clear their heads enough to go to the police. At least not until Libby called me up to Mount San Jacinto. Running off to the desert was Shannon's idea. The dispute between Carr and Conroy had created a crisis. The two women got themselves so worked up about that fight Shannon overheard that they ran for it. Once they got to the La Quinta resort, they bickered. Shannon says the thing that bothered Libby most about the whole mess was that Shannon had been in Carr's house when she eavesdropped and then took that rosary. Libby was enraged to find out Carr was sleeping with them both. That night in Cathedral City, they fought over him. When they got back to Shannon's car after dinner and wine, their fighting got physical. Shannon got a nosebleed. They both called Carr, as we already know. They didn't ask him anything about Sally, but demanded that he choose between them. Instead, he played them both, told Libby to get a cab and go back to the La Quinta resort. He picked up Shannon and ran the "You're the love of my life" routine on her. After that, he stashed Shannon in a condo out here in the desert, knocked her out with drugs, and she didn't see him until the next day. Carr must have paid Libby a visit to cool her down. Maybe that's when she cleaned out his Mercedes and added more lovely items to her little blue suitcase a few days later when she went back to Manhattan Beach. I'm not sure how Libby got the idea Shannon was dead, but maybe it was the timing of her disappearance, the stuff she found in his car, or just wishful thinking.
Whoa, that car dude was busy, Brian said. Somebody was following Libby. Who was that?
That's a great question. Carr had his hands full juggling Conroy and those two women, and who knows what else. He must have hired someone to keep tabs on her. Maybe Conroy suggested it after the confrontation he and Carr had about his involvement with troubled women, she replied.
We know Carr checked into a hotel the weekend he died. He got that call on his cell phone around 12:30, later traced to a burner phone, so the hired hand idea makes sense. That must be how he learned that Libby and Jessica were together up there. Shannon seemed like she was doing what Carr had told her to do, staying out of sight, until Carr fell and broke his neck. That's what killed him, not the gunshot. Anyway, after she died, she made it her business to stalk you, Jessica, Frank said.
Shannon was about as far off the deep end over Carr as Sally had been about Conroy. I gather that's why she was trailing me and took those shots at us on Rodeo Drive, trying to make me pay for his death.
She's got skills if she could keep up with you, Jessica,
Peter said.
Even Brian didn't spot her. I wasn't looking for Shannon, man. Why didn't you see her, Uber Thor?
You guys were on the lookout for a skilled sniper, not a nondescript 30-something woman in baggy sweats and a hoodie or a baseball cap. Besides, we all thought she was dead.
Well, she won't get to use her skills. For a while, anyway, Kim said.
Yeah, she's likely to do some prison time for the list of misdeeds to her credit. Although a good lawyer might make a diminished capacity claim stick, Jessica said.
In her case, that could be right, Betsy said.
A lot of what she's done makes no sense. Like shooting at you when she had the red devil in her sights at the marina, Laura added. To Shannon, I must have seemed like the bigger devil than Conroy. Shannon says she thought I ruined everything. She got it into her head that I called Carr that day and lured him up there to kill him. Maybe she was with him when he got that call, and he was fuming about me being up there with Libby. Put two and two together, but had the math all wrong. You're right, Laura, that it makes no sense. She makes no sense.
None of these women do. Starting with Sally Winchester, Kim said.
Sally's diary reads like a gothic romance novel, that's for sure. Suspenseful, too, knowing what was going on as she agreed to go against her family to help the first man who ever showed her so much attention. He was her first lover, too. That's a heartbreaking apology to her mother for using her father as fodder in Conroy's plotting at Pinnacle. After Sally started treatment with Carr and he loaded her up on drugs, she went downhill fast. Still, she was lucid enough to put a lot of the pieces together about the fraud going on at Pinnacle. She gave that diary to Father Caverly for safekeeping because it contained information about a safe deposit box. That's where she placed the evidence gathered about Pinnacle before she called the feds. I hope some of what she wrote brings Dottie consolation, if she can bring herself to read it.
Yes, let's hope so. This has been terrible for Dottie, even now that both those maleantes are dead. Lucky for her, she's so tough. She has to find a new assistant now, too.
Andrea Jessup and Carla Ferguson are singing at the top of their lungs, Frank added. The feds arrested Carla Ferguson's boss, Pinnacle's chief financial officer. He colluded with Conroy to raid the coffers at Pinnacle, cook the books, and stash money in offshore accounts. Carla helped them implement their plans. That's how she knew enough to go rogue on Conroy. Plan A was to steal hundreds of millions from that IPO. Plan B was to make do with the tens of millions the culprits had already squirreled away. The yacht was part of the getaway strategy in either case. Conroy must have had no clue the two women he'd enlisted to help him had come up with a plan of their own. Andrea kept him in the loop about developments in the Winchester household, even before Sally moved out. Conroy had Andrea over a barrel, blackmailing her about an arrest that had occurred years before. The police never charged her, and she had the arrest expunged from her record. Expunged doesn't mean gone, however. He threatened to tell Dottie Winchester unless she cooperated.
Does that mean the feds had figured out Andrea was in cahoots with Conroy?
Jessica asked. Yes. The feds launched that raid on half a dozen locations all at once that morning when you and Bernadette went to meet with Carla, without telling me. That included the Winchester estate, where they were after Andrea and the record Sally used to expose the fraud at Pinnacle. They didn't know about the safe deposit box until you all recovered that diary from Father Caverly. They would have picked Andrea up, too, but she wasn't in the house. Conroy had ordered her to find Sally's missing diary by morning, or else. It turns out Kirk was the or else. He was at the Winchester estate looking for Andrea. If she didn't give him that diary, Conroy ordered Kirk to get rid of her. Kirk was lurking when the feds moved in. He found out enough about the operation that morning to call Conroy with that heads up while you were sitting in his office. Anyway, Andrea was out in a storage area searching for the diary when the feds moved in. She slipped out before the authorities located her, got a text message from Carla about Plan B, and headed to the marina in a cab.
Andrea had some secrets of her own, besides the one she was keeping from Dottie, Bernadette said.
That's for sure. Jessica was right about Carla's anger and defiance toward Conroy. She and Andrea had hooked up months earlier and planned that mutiny. If Shannon hadn't shown up and started shooting, there's a good chance Andrea and Carla would have killed Conroy and fled by the time the feds got to the marina. Carla claims they would have let you and Bernadette go, Jessica. Maybe, but you two weren't part of the plan any more than Shannon was, nor could they have known you'd get a message to Peter with the inside track on their escape route.
Well, I figured the feds had the yacht on their list of locations to hit that day, too, at some point. I'm grateful Peter got help there quick, though. Carla must have information the feds can use to recover the money stashed in offshore accounts, right?
Yes. She's using that to negotiate with the feds for leniency for herself and her gal pal.
Okay, so my head is spinning. I must have missed something. How did Shannon end up at that marina?
Laura asked.
Kismet. As much as that grates on Detective Hernandez, it's as good an explanation as any. Shannon took a wrong turn that turned out right. She followed us from the desert to Beverly Hills and was loitering around the Beverly Wilshire. That's how she knew she could find us at Tiffany's. She overheard us talking about going back to Dottie Winchester's estate for another conversation with Andrea. Her plan was to get there ahead of us and wait for me to show up so she could shoot me, Jessica said, shuddering.
That was stupid, Brian said. Why didn't she just shoot you in the lobby?
I don't know, but I imagine it had something to do with wanting to get away with murder. If I get a chance, I'll ask her, Jessica said.
If she'd made a move on you in the lobby of the Beverly Wilshire, I like to think I could have stopped her. Where was I when she was close enough to hear our conversation?
I don't know that either, Peter. I'll put it on the list of questions for my next interview with Shannon, which I hope happens never. By the time Shannon got to Dottie's, the raid was underway. She was trying to get out of there when she spotted Andrea making her escape. You won't believe this, but Shannon's the one who gave Andrea a lift to a cab stand in downtown San Marino. While she was in the car with Shannon, Andrea called Carla and left a message. Something like, Carla, I'm on my way to the marina. I'll be ready when you and Conroy get there with Jessica Huntington. All Shannon had to do was follow that cab.
Okay. Well, that answers my first question, Laura said. Last question, I promise. What's with the sniper?
I can answer that one, Frank replied. The helicopter tracked him down, and the police cornered him. They had him surrounded, so he surrendered. He's playing Let's Make a Deal too, so who knows what will happen to him. They may give him life in prison in exchange for information about members of La Creme de la Crud who have hired him over the years. Not just Conroy, but other people with the money to pay Kirk, as he prefers to be called, to do their dirty work. He sure made it obvious when he shot, reminded Conroy he did not like being called Kierkegaard. Conroy was trying to stiff him, too, refusing to pay for that botched attempt on Libby's life, so he had more than one reason to shoot Conroy. Kirk also claims he couldn't just stand there and watch Conroy shoot an unarmed woman. Shannon had a gun, but was out of bullets, and Conroy had a gun pointed right at her. That's why I took a shot at him. It sounds like I missed him, though, Jessica said.
It's okay. That sniper got him. Kirk won't be shooting at you or anyone else, since the cops got him now, too.
Bernadette was trying to look on the bright side, as usual. Jessica still wasn't feeling great about the fact that she had fired a gun at a human being, even one as loathsome as Eric Conroy.
Thank God this is almost over. I will be so glad when this year comes to an end. We are having a New Year's Eve party, and at 12:01, I will burn the 2013 calendar. What gives? Are all these people mentally ill, or just miserable, evil people?
Some of the trouble is due to mental illness, but as I've said to you before, most people with mental health problems are more likely to be victims of crime and violence than perpetrators. It's human nature. Good and evil playing out around us.
You sound like Father Martin, Jessica said.
Could be. But have you heard the Cherokee story of the two wolves? My Kaweah great-grandmother told me the story when I was very young.
I could use a good story after this bad one.
Tell us, okay? Brian asked. According to legend, an old Cherokee is teaching his grandson about life, Betsy began. A fight is going on inside me, he said to the boy. It is a terrible fight, and it is between two wolves. One is evil. He is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. He continued, the other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside you, and inside every other person, too. The grandson thought about it for a minute, and then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, the one you feed. The troubled daughters of Beverly Hills seem to have been feeding the wrong wolf, Betsy said.
That was a good story, Betsy. You're right about those 90210 girls, Bernadette said. That Dr. Dick and the Red Devil, too. If you have another story like that, don't tell it yet. I need to check on dinner, but I'll be right back.
Bernadette scurried into the house, calling out to the caterers as she entered. Jessica was about to speak when her cell phone rang. She recognized the phone number belonging to her ex, but took the call anyway.
Speaking of wolves, she said.
Hello, Jim.
Jessica, it's Jim.
Yes, I know. That's why I said, hello, Jim.
She rolled her eyes.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I think I've made a horrible mistake, and I'm in trouble, Jim said, in the weirdest tone of voice she had ever heard him use. She wasn't sure if he was crying or on the verge of tears, or maybe he'd had one too many margaritas. His speech sounded slurred. Her mind was racing, trying to figure out if this was a personal call or a professional one.
What kind of trouble? She asked. All eyes were on her. Before she could reply, the screen door slid open with a crack, and Bernadette flew out onto the patio.
Jessica, Giovanni just called. It's Alexis.
They've taken her to UCLA Medical Center in an ambulance. Giovanni says she's asking for you. We need to get there as soon as possible. Frank, do you have your cop light to put on the top of your car?
Frank, already on his feet, was buttoning his shirt and pulling on a pair of sweatpants he had worn over his trunks. Jessica was trying to process what was going on when she heard Jim's voice calling to her as if from a great distance.
Jim, I've got a situation here. It's Mom. Something's happened and we've got to get to L.A. right away. I'll get back with you once we're on the road, okay?
She couldn't hear what he was saying. His response was muffled.
Jim, are you all right? You didn't take anything, did you?
She wasn't sure why she'd even asked that question. Maybe because she was worried that's what her mother had done. He didn't answer.
Jim, are you there? Where are you?
She asked several more times before she got an address from him. Frank was on the phone to a dispatcher with 911 asking for help to be sent to that address.
Go, you guys, go, Laura urged them. We'll take care of things here.
Thanks, Jessica said, as she, Bernadette, and Frank dashed to his car.
This year isn't over yet, Jessica thought, as she got into Frank's car and called Giovanni.
This concludes A Dead Daughter by Anna Celeste Burke, narrated by Rebecca Mitchell. Copyright 2015 by Anna Celeste Burke. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Anna Celeste Burke and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.